This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Yo, take three. Welcome to the Orange Bloods Modcast. I'm Jeff Ketchum from orangebloods.com, joined today, as always, by all five of the orangebloods.com staff members, Anwar, Alex, Dustin, Jason. Fellas, quite a week that we've had. It's a bit chaotic. We've had a program-changing win over Kansas State, apparently. We've had Urban Meyer saying no. We've had the chaos that has unfolded from Urban Meyer apparently saying no, although conspiracy theorists are keeping that dream alive. Anwar, I will start with you. It's been a complicated week. We've got a lot of confused listeners and subscribers. And from your perspective, your finger on the pulse of this moment in time of University of Texas football and athletics, is it as simple as saying we're all witnessing one gigantic clusterfuck?
Well, what we seemingly are witnessing is what happens when you don't 100% pull the trigger on getting rid of someone, when you kind of leave a wiggle room for that person to potentially return. But what we're really seeing is that kind of maybe a mismanagement and a mishandling of this whole entire situation with, you know, Chris Del Conte and Tom Herman, because, you know, at the end of the day, if Chris Del Conte doesn't alienate Tom Herman, alienate the football program, and make it seem like at the end of the day, Tom Herman is fired no matter what, then it probably wouldn't be as confusing, and fans wouldn't be as confused as they are now, because I think they operated based on the assumption of, based on what they were seeing, that Tom Herman was a dead man walking. But clearly that wasn't 100% how Chris Del Conte felt. And then that raises a whole lot of other questions. I'm not trying to turn this into a Del Conte bash fest, just pointing out the facts of it. So, you know, right now, look, there's no clusterfuck to say you went after Urban Meyer, right? If you have an opportunity to obtain that guy and he's willing to listen, you give him the pitch. You give him the pitch of pitches and you go full steam ahead like that. There's no problem with that. The problem is the alternative plans, the things that seemingly hadn't been thought of, because as of right now, you've got a coach who was dangling in the wind for several weeks, couple of months, who, because of the, you know, or the lack thereof, of at least having Urban at this moment, there doesn't seem to be a better option. And even if they had better options, they don't seem to be wanting to pull the trigger on them. So, yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I wrote on Sunday, if not Urban, then Herman, and which got a lot of reaction, even from you. But that seems to be right now, as of today, and this, you know, where we were last week is different than we were this week. That's the seems to be the way it's trending.
Well, it's funny, Anwar. Dustin and I kind of, there's a whole lot of, it doesn't make sense. So it's when you replay the events as they've unfolded that it's hard to grapple with this idea of, well wait a minute now. The guy who hasn't commented on the football program all year long, who's been upset at the coach, the Eyes of Texas controversy, cutting him off at the legs, now Urban says no, and, you know, there's a victim of circumstances? You know, Dustin, I struggle. Your column on Wednesday, which, by the way, was one of my – you always write good columns, but Wednesdays I thought was highly entertaining and informative, more than usual. We're both kind of in the same place. Like, there's just common sense doesn't add up to where we are right now. And I suppose the answer that I'm going to throw this to, that the idea of, is Texas a victim of circumstances or circumstances that it created – it feels like the answer is just yes. And and it's not Monday morning quarterbacking to look at the process that's got us into this position right now while they're still in it and scratch your head a little bit and go, this is some real Mickey Mouse management that's taking place in terms of Anwar's right, man. You can go after Urban Meyer and nobody's going to fault you. But to undermine your coach for 9 weeks screamed that, well, when this thing's all over with, change will be made and Urban's the first guy they're going to go after in terms of change. It shouldn't be shocking that he said no. Like, that's where a lot of Texas fans are today. Some of them felt like, well, that was a Hail Mary anyway. So are you telling me that we put all our chips into a Hail Mary and then it felt incomplete and now everybody is surprised at the last grasp, 60-yard pass in the air into like a handful of bodies didn't get completed? And the answer seems to be yeah from Texas people right now. There isn't a clear plan. How we got here is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And I think they're a victim of their own circumstances. And I'm glad you brought up this week's column, because last week I wrote there is literally no sign that supported Tom Herman coming back. And man, how things have changed in a week, because it just doesn't make any sense when you look at just all those factors, you know, some of which you and Anwar already mentioned. I mean, Chris Del Conte's silence about the program, which is basically just – indirectly said that, hey, a change is coming because I'm not going to support this coach, and Tom Herman coming out and having to give himself a self-endorsement, and then the pursuit of Urban Meyer, which, oh, by the way, how often do we ever see in college athletics an athletic department go pursue another coach only to bring back the current coach for another season? Like, what kind of message does that send to your fan base, to your donor base, to your head coach, to your athletic department? And oh, by the way, this follows all that period of time when, you know, the athletic director was completely silent about the football program. So it just doesn't make any sense. And, you know, to have this buildup where it just seemed like, you know, we've all heard behind the scenes, seems like for the last 2 months, like, oh, you know, change is coming. This is building up. And, you know, that's why there's this silence and Urban Meyer and this and that. Well, okay, that all that sort of Urban Meyer pursuit and that thing was going to happen. But like you said, you had all this time, and now it's just like, oh, you know, Urban said no, as many people thought he would, and we just don't know what we're going to do now. Like, that's, I think, a Mickey Mouse operation is a great way to put it, because it doesn't make any sense. You know, you've already got a fan base that's growing apathetic by the day, and, you know, it's seemingly a very disgruntled donor base that, you know, in a time where you need to get people back into the stadium next year coming out of a pandemic, you need people to keep writing those checks for the South End Zone and everything else that's going on fundraising wise. And yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. And when you just kind of look at this timeline, it's like they had all of this time and they knew they're going to pursue Urban Meyer. They knew that there was a very real chance that he was going to say no. And the option is going to be, okay, we'll just try to run it back with the guy that we haven't ever publicly supported. And, you know, knowing that it's probably going to make a lot of people upset, I don't really find, you know, any example of that points to, you know, not making a change. It's just bizarre how they reached this point. And I think that they're a victim of their own created circumstances, because they put themselves in this mess by the way they played out the last few months of the season.
And Alex, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I was just going to add in on what Dustin said. That's like, in many ways, like, Tom Herman is screwed. Like, it, and you would, no matter what you want to think of him as a coach, I think we can talk about him. You know, we did this kind of on our Monday thing. What you feel about him as a coach and what he hasn't achieved, I think is all fair game, right? But when you think about, like, from a recruiting perspective,
How does that guy recruit now, Anwar?
Well, how does he try to finish off 2021 when you still don't know what the future is? And how does he recruit if he comes back? He's literally a lame duck coach. Like, he's lame duck.
It wasn't like every other coach. It wasn't like he was going gangbusters before, though.
No,
it's like now there's this new excuse. It's like,
this makes an incredibly tough task damn near impossible. You don't think Lincoln Riley and Jimbo Fisher are going to point that out to every recruit that they're going after? They're probably already doing it to a guy like LJ Johnson. Right.
Well, no, man, I'm just saying that it's going to be even worse than the bad that it was.
Yeah,
I'm just pointing out that the bad recruiting is not all a direct result of this. Recruiting was going bad before.
No, you're right. It was, but it's 2022 is probably going to be as bad or worse. And, you know, I wrote this on Tuesday in my column. I said, if Urban has told them no, and Del Conte knows he's not coming, and Del Conte, if he knows, or as soon as he knows that Tom Herman's going to be back next year, man, he needs to come out with a strongly worded vote of confidence, because that's the only chance that Texas has, really. But even recruits aren't going to believe that. I mean, listen, you come out and say, oh yeah, Tom Herman's our guy and we're excited to have him, you know, next year, and, you know, big things on the horizon. And then Jimbo Fisher says to the same recruit, hey, you know, they were trying to replace him in December, and they're only bringing him back because they couldn't get the guy they wanted. You don't think they're going to be looking to do the same this time next year? So, yeah, man, you guys are talking about everything you're talking about is accurate, but from a recruiting perspective, it's been just grossly mishandled. And Omar, you're right. You know, you can shit on Tom Herman, but he's not getting any help from his administration from a recruiting perspective, man. They're making it tougher than it even needs to be for him.
Jason, I don't know that I've ever asked you specifically this question, but, you know, and Anwar and I talked about this on Monday, and it's been a conversation for months now, but when we go back to the Eyes of Texas thing, you know, one of the positions that I held in the beginning was that, you know, for the football program's protection, he needed support on that. And instead, behind the scenes, finger pointing was aimed at Herman in a way that led the fan base to really kind of make him the boogeyman for that whole complicated is the perfect word. It's a complicated situation. And he got the finger pointed at him. And I always felt like that for recruiting purposes, for in a situation where at the end of the year, when that first thing was going on, it wasn't automatically assumed that Herman was going to lose his job. I mean, when they had the mishap after game one, when they beat UTEP, they were near the top 10 and the Eyes of Texas was already a controversy, and they played it like right after the game ends, and then the athletic department and then Herman himself having to, well, we didn't know, and there was confusion, and somebody pushed a button early, and that was the first week of the season. And then we somehow found a way to get to the middle point of the season, and it was still a thing, and that none of it made any sense. I personally believe that Quinn Ewers is probably still a Texas commitment. Who knows? Maybe he would have peeled off a little later. Maybe now he peels off. I don't know. But the Eyes of Texas thing was a big element of what he did. They were watching what they believed to be a shit show. Suddenly, you don't know if the coach that you committed to, you have any confidence that he's going to be around, because as a Texas fan, he and his dad were watching this, and they're like, this don't look good. And here we are, not all of the lack of support that has existed since the first week of October. Now we're into December, and I feel like Chris Del Conte's fingerprints are on that decommitment. That had that situation just played out differently, and he could have been as mad as he wanted to be about Tom Herman behind the scenes, but publicly, there needed to be a look to this that didn't blame the head football coach that still trying to recruit, still trying to get LJ Johnsons of the world, still trying to keep the Billy Bowmans of the world. Recruiting was already in a precarious position, to say the least, with 2022 or 2021 kids. But they had the Ewers commitment that was giving them some perceived momentum in 2022. I just don't think he decommits as early as he did without the Eyes of Texas thing pushing him out the door. And I blame that.
I disagree with you.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not saying it wasn't probably something he and his family discussed, just as it relates to the overall program being in a shit show state at that point. But no, I think there's a lot more to it than the Eyes of Texas. I think it just come down to, and honestly, I think if you look at Texas and Ohio State, they're on two completely, they're in two different worlds in college football. And I think Quinn Ewers wants to go somewhere where he knows he will be competing for championships instead of going to a place like Texas where he, thought maybe he'll have a chance, and he's going to have to potentially be that part of that savior that's going to maybe lead Texas back, where if he knows he goes to Ohio State, he knows he's going to be competing for championships on the biggest stage. His family has some connections there in the state of Ohio. I guess it's been reported, and I was talking to someone else. They've got a ranch up there. And listen, I mean, I've heard if Texas had landed Urban Meyer, and I don't know if this is true, Quinn's never said this, but, you know, I think he would have had an interest in Texas again. So to me, and I'd heard that, but again, it's not coming from Quinn. But
Jason, real quick, he committed.
That has nothing to do with the eyes of Texas. If Urban, it comes down to the direction of the program.
He committed in August and left like 2 weeks after the eyes of Texas thing started.
But I told you all kind of behind the scenes before that Oklahoma game, and I think I said it on the board, I kind of insinuated, hey, Texas could really help themselves by winning that game. It wasn't about the eyes of Texas. That eyes of Texas fiasco really blew up after that Oklahoma game with the Sam picture going viral. He was wavering long before that.
I'm saying, though, Jason, that he doesn't decommit when he did.
I disagree. In fact, okay. He held out a little longer. I thought he might decommit right after that Oklahoma game. He held out a few more weeks before he decommitted. So I don't think the eyes of Texas – and then, listen, I'm not saying it's not something that he and his family didn't discuss in terms of just the overall view of the program – but I think it's way down the list of why he decommitted.
Well, I've heard.
Quinn's never said. Quinn's, he's a pretty private kid. So, I mean, that's kind of me reading the tea leaves.
Now that everything that's happened has happened, that you can't go back. Like, that ultimately was my response to Anwar's column on Sunday. And I even wrote in my column, I like Tom. Like, in a universe where he's got a top 10 national class this year, and we're talking about 7-3 being a disappointment, but it's not really reflected in recruiting, which is what Tom, which is how Mac Brown survived for so many years. Remember, it wasn't until year 6 that Mac won a conference championship. The difference between Mac and Herman is that at the end of a failure in year 4 for Mac Brown, he signed the number one recruiting class in the country with Vince Young. That happened.
So there was a light at the end of the tunnel.
Oh, you
don't see that right now.
And yours provided cover for Herman in that capacity, because it was like, oh, 2021 recruiting is in the crapper. We didn't get the Brockermeyers. We're not getting Kamar Wheaton. We're not getting Foster. Like, you just rattle them all off. And it's like, we might get a lot of guys in 2022 because the number one rated prospect in the country at quarterback is committed to you. But when he decommitted and the rest of recruiting was then left to just kind of speak for itself, it didn't speak well. That's the difference. The difference is, if Herman was still recruiting at even a semi-reasonable level, I think you could run the let's run it back and give him another year and you'd be okay. You'd survive. But everybody and their mom knows that recruiting is not okay. It only goes downhill from here with these circumstances, and this is through Texas's own doing. They gave the extension. They created the optics that Herman was a bit of a boogeyman with the eyes of Texas and kind of turned the fan base even more against him. And then they make the run after Urban Meyer. And look, Anwar and I agree. Like, I think everybody agrees you have to go after Urban, but you have to be prepared for the consequences if you don't get him. And this appears to be a situation where the school is not completely prepared for those consequences. And I don't know how this works out, I guess. Does anybody have an idea for how in 12 months from now we look back on this?
We're having the same conversation. No, I think we're having – barring Texas catching lightning in a bottle with Casey Thompson or Hudson Card and – you know, somehow miraculously competing for the Big 12 championship next year, we're having the same, I think I'd be surprised if anybody disagreed, but we'll be having these same conversations next year, and they'll be talking about who's Tom Herman's replacement. I mean, listen, going into the season next year, you'll see these, who are the coaches on the hot seat. Tom Herman is going to be on top of every single one of those lists, and that makes it tough to recruit, and it's justifiable. It's not just media pundits predicting it. You can say, well, hey, he was on the hot seat last year. They tried to replace him in November and December of last year. They just couldn't get it done. And there's so many places we could take this conversation. But I do, you know, Anwar and I both said, and maybe somebody else did too on this podcast a few weeks ago, like, we both thought it was silly that firing Tom Herman could come down to basically what amounted to a Justin Tucker kick sailing wide left by a foot. If Dicker makes that kick, then we're probably not even having that conversation as much. But I don't know. I mean, maybe, Dustin, you're pretty good at history. I can't think of another time where a team was actively chasing, and everybody knew about it, chasing a head coach's replacement while the head coach was still on staff and still in limbo about whether or not he's going to keep his job. I mean, clearly the decision hadn't 100% been made. Chris Del Conte, I mean, I've thought this, and Anwar, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think Anwar said something similar. If you want to fire Tom Herman, that decision should have been made a month ago, 2 months ago, whatever it was. And you make the decision and you have a plan and you move forward. If it ends up not being Urban Meyer, then you have your backup plans. This whole fly by the seat of my pants and change things from day to day and week to week and not having backup plans and, hey, we were going to fire him, but you know, we couldn't get Urban. And, you know, well, if Dicker makes that kick, maybe they wouldn't have fired him regardless. I mean, it's just so unorganized. And I just don't understand not having an actual concrete plan on such a big decision. And you're going to base so many of your follow-up actions on something that happens on the here and now, instead of taking a big picture look. Take a big picture look at recruiting. Take a big picture look at the direction of the program. Take a big picture look at the record that Tom Herman has produced. Take a big picture look at whether or not this is you think it's going to be a championship program. Make your decision based on that. It shouldn't be based on, you know, now they don't have a suitable replacement, they don't think, or a plan for what happened with Urban. It shouldn't be based on whether or not Texas beat Iowa State. It should be a big picture approach. And I'm not advocating replacing Herman or bringing him back. That's not what I'm getting at. My point is, the way Del Conte has handled this, it just seems amateurish, and it seems like he's in way over his head to me.
Well, the thing that you do, Jason, and what could have just been done, and again, don't want to turn this into Del Conte bash fest, because Ketch and I will get all types of calls and emails from his people sometime this afternoon on Friday. But we'll still say what we need to say. But you know what? When this thing happens and everything with the eyes of Texas is going crazy, you know, this is where Del Conte comes out and then says, hey guys, to the fan base, okay? Hey, listen, there's a lot of miscommunication. Some of that's on me. I need to sit down with this team. I need to get things right. But listen, at the end of the day, Tom Herman's our guy. I support him. We just got to get through the season, yada, yada, yada. And you give him a cover. Now, after the day after Kansas, the moment after Kansas, if you fire him, right? But when you alienate him because everyone else is kind of pissed off and it's kind of like, yeah, and then becomes this kind of like feud and, you know, things are like, oh, well, I put things in the newsletter and it's like, well, what is the newsletter, any AD's newsletter ever been on SportsCenter? Like, when has any AD's newsletter ever been on the crawl from any sports program that you watch? Like, what gets on SportsCenter, what gets on the crawl, what gets on all these other things is when – or gets aggregated is when you stand behind a microphone and you say, this is what's going on. And that's when people listen to it. When you put in a newsletter, it's like, eh. So if he would have given it a cover and said, hey, just squash that whole thing, the whole beef, this, all the whatever that was going on, and said, we'll handle that, but that's still my guy. Then if you make the move afterwards, everyone's like, cool. But if you have a beef and then the Urban thing is happening, and then the Urban thing doesn't come about, and now it's like, well, Crystal Ball's kind of lost two games, and James Franklin isn't really having the best season, there's nothing else. Then it's like, well, why'd you even alienate the guy? And you want to bring him back knowing that, to Jason's point, you're probably just waiting to find a replacement for next year. I mean, it's really, you know, in the NFL, they always say, I'll tolerate you until I can replace you. That's what it's starting to seem like with Tom Herman. So probably could have been handled better. For Chris, you know, maybe to his slight defense, this is a big job, and these are circumstances that he just did not anticipate. And I think he went into survival mode and had a lot of big money people who were upset and started thinking he needed to make sure they were happy and probably didn't know what to do. But at the end of the day, you know, by not protecting your football coach, you inadvertently, and not purposely, but inadvertently hurt the program. You kind of hurt recruiting. To Alex's point, yes, it wasn't going great, but it doesn't seem like it'll get better. Like the potential of hope seems to be, you know, thrown out the door. And at this point, a Tom Herman, if he comes back, is going to have to coach the shit out of what he's got remaining and hope like hell that they can get some guys in January for that one-time transfer rule as some reinforcement.
I am looking forward to the answer from each and every one of you to the following question. And Alex, I'll start with you. Just tell me what's given where we are now, right? So no revisionist stuff. We can't go back and say Chris Del Conte should have done this. We are where we are now. Give me your what you would do set of plans. In your mind, what would work for you based on the circumstances that aren't great now?
Well, I guess this would be with the caveat. It's like, I feel like Del Conte probably has some things to do with figuring out Ketchum. You've made a point before talking about how you've heard from some of your people behind the scenes that during this pandemic are, you know, people get used to new people adapt, right? And during this pandemic, there could be some behaviors that changed, you know, and sometimes when people change their behaviors, they don't necessarily go back. And one of the things about getting rid of Herman and getting somebody else in here was to ensure that there'd be some excitement around the program and to ensure that, you know, if people's behaviors had changed, maybe they're not as likely to come back, or they're, you know, still a little bit spooked about going back to public spaces, or if they just realized during this year, they're like, hey man, not driving in every day from every weekend from Dallas, this was actually kind of nice. You know, we got this nice new TV. It's easy to watch from home. I think that what I do is I would look and I would say, okay, we got this buyout for Herman. It's what, 15 million. Now is the fact that we cannot get from the big money guys, are we going to be losing money from them if we don't get rid of Herman? Is there going to be an issue where we can offset the amount that, you know, we're going to need to raise for the south end zone by the fact that maybe we could get some extra butts in the seats if there were a new coach? And does a new coach move the needle enough there to where we're going to be able to ask, you know, some of these big money guys that are already on the hook in Texas, of course, which has been hit with the, you know, oil and natural gas and everything else during the pandemic. Is that going to be enough to offset what, you know, what these guys were willing to chip in before? We have this much pledged, we have, you know, and then we put a buyout on top of that. I think that there'd be some math that I would have to work out. But if the math worked out in a way to where it was in any way reasonable to get rid of Tom Herman, I would be getting rid of Tom Herman. Because at this point in time, you know, Tom Herman, it's like you don't view him as a fidelity risk because it wasn't like he was the one that got caught looking around. It's like the admin is the fidelity risk. And whenever a fidelity risk involves in any sort of professional relationship, my dad did study after study after study on this. And whenever a fidelity risk is involved in a professional relationship, the simple fact of the matter is that professional relationship will not last. It's not going to stand the test of time for anything more than, you know, 12 to 18 months in virtually all cases across all industries. So I would say, you know, I'd start getting on the horn with some of these other, you know, search
Alex,
firms.
Who would make you've heard the names. Is there any name that's out there that floats your boat?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I think that there are a few names. I think at this point in time, especially if it's somebody that you look, I don't think there's going to be a Dabo hire. I don't think there's going to be an Urban hire or a Saban or any crazy shit like Kyle Shanahan. I don't think that can happen. But I think that people would be just as happy to see somebody else that was an up and coming coach like Herman was whenever he came here. I'm not necessarily on board with the Jeff Traylor stuff, I could certainly see it. I could, you know, Jason's talked about Graham Harrell. I kind of like that. I personally like Bob Stoops. Nobody thinks that that's viable for some reason that I can't understand. A guy who's coached here. I brought up Joe Brady on the podcast when we were first talking about off the wall. I mean, you talk about a guy that would get, you know, talking about a guy that would get recruiting going for sure. I don't think I would be as interested in, if I was in Cristo Conti's spot, in having to buy out Tom Herman and then having to pay something close to the Urban Meyer stuff to a guy like Cristobal or to a guy like James Franklin, where it's like, if things go bad with this guy, I'm on the hook with him. And all of a sudden that now, instead of being set back a decade, the program set back 2 decades because of these big contracts that have been attached to these guys.
Like the extension that was given. Dustin, I'm going to come to you with the same question. You're Cristo Conti. Make the hire that makes you, Dustin McComas, happy.
So I my decision is made, and I'm making a change and making a hire. It didn't take long. Yeah. Well, I mean, that you just said it for me. I'm not going to disagree with you. I guess, whatever, after the Kansas game, if it's played, hey, you know, thanks, but we're moving a different direction. I look at recent history and a lot of these top programs, and they've made hires of guys that had no head coaching experience, and they've been able to have a lot of success with them. I mean, the Lincoln Rileys, the Kirby Smarts, Dabo Swinney was a damn receivers coach when he was elevated to take over Clemson. Like, the idea that you have to have these proven guys that have all this head coaching experience, programs have had success not doing that. Jimbo Fisher had no head coaching experience when he went to Florida State and ended up winning a national championship there. Does the risk increase when you take a chance on a guy like that that doesn't necessarily have that experience? Perhaps, yeah. But as we've learned at Texas, there's plenty of risk in taking, you know, the chance with a guy like a Charlie Strong or a Tom Herman that has some head coaching experience, but not a lot of head coaching experience. So, I would my list would most certainly include all of those top coordinators in the country right now, and guys, especially at programs that have routinely experienced a lot of success and who have routinely recruited at a high level. The Tony Elliott name at Clemson to me would make a lot of sense. That my list would include guys like that, guys that have been around winning. They've been around the championship program at the highest level. They've consistently been able to recruit. They've seen what a good staff looks like. They've seen a support staff. They've seen the top facilities. They've been fully immersed in that type of winning for a long, long time. You know, that Lincoln Riley had a couple years at OU before he took that over. Jimbo Fisher at Florida State under Bobby Bowden before he took that over. Kirby Smart for years and years and years under Nick Saban before he took Georgia over. Like, it's not a coincidence that those guys were surrounded by what a championship football program looks like before they were actually handed the keys to one. So I think that, yeah, you can, you know, throw your hat at those guys, you know, I don't know, a Brian Kelly and make him say no or something like that. I don't think there's any chance a guy like Dan Mullen would ever leave a place like Florida. But yeah, you need to do your due diligence with those guys and see if there's any interest there. But I would look at a lot of top coordinators around the country and ask myself and do a lot of digging, you know, can this be the next Lincoln Riley? Can this be the next Kirby Smart? Can this be the next Jimbo Fisher when he was at Florida State? Because we've seen a lot of programs, you know, next year, Nick Saban's not going to be available next year. Urban Meyer's probably not going to be, you know, coming out of that television booth. Dabo Swinney's not going to be available next year. Like, the idea that there's just that, you know, Chris Del Conte thinks he can just punt for a year and there's going to be just no doubt slam dunk hire just waiting to be made is unrealistic. You know, it's the job of an athletic director to have plans B, C, D, E, F, whatever, and have the finger on the pulse of who is the next guy. Who is the next Lincoln Riley in college football? Who is the next Kirby Smart in college football? And pick a name.
I just want to hear a name.
I like the Elliott name. I do. And I don't think Sukumel's suggestion of Graham Harrell is that outrageous either. Now, you know, how the fan base would react to that, I'm not quite sure. I think they're so disgruntled with Tom Herman, they'll just take anything at this point, as long as it's not just some outlandish off the wall NFL name or something like that. But I think the Elliott name would make a lot of sense to me.
Anwar, I'm going to go to you last. Jason, same question, same scenario, just in your mind right now, the best solution to this problem would be what?
Well, Dustin pretty much summed up what I feel very thoroughly. what you've done, you know, I think it's an arrogant approach by Texas. We've got to have someone with experience, and Dan Mullen. And I mean, come on, let's be somewhat realistic. I mean, to act like the Texas job is so much better than the Florida job, and Dan Mullen would come running to Texas, or Brian Kelly. I mean, Texas needs a little bit of a reality check. And they also need to realize what they've done by insisting on getting the hot coach who has some coaching, head coaching experience, has failed them miserably the last two times. Maybe it's time to think outside the box a little bit. Dustin mentioned, I think, Tony Elliott. You know, it wasn't my suggestion, to be clear. You know, I thought Graham Harrell would have been a great candidate for the Texas offensive coordinator job. And J.S. Horn on the board suggested him. And I was like, you know what? I hadn't really even – he never crossed my mind as a head coaching candidate. But, man, that makes a lot of sense with his ties to the state and his dad's still a coach in the state. And this guy's going to be a career coach. He's from the Leach coaching tree. Graham Harrell's going to be a superstar coach. I don't have a doubt about that in my mind, whether it's at Texas or somewhere else or when it'll happen, I don't know. But I think he's going to be a great coach for somebody at some point. Tony Elliott, you know, if you need a guy with some head coaching experience, take a look at Steve Sarkisian. I mean, yeah, he obviously went off the rails there for a little bit. You know, the guy can coach. He can recruit. His one full season at USC was productive. He's got experience as a head coach at Washington. I think Texas needs to look outside the box a little bit, find a young, innovative coach that can come in and kind of just give this program a shot in the arm in terms of some energy, in terms of some offensive creativity. And don't be so focused on experience. I mean, it's been proven, Dustin mentioned several examples time and time again, you know, guys that have been in big time programs can come into a program like Texas. And I get it. Texas is different from Oklahoma and Florida State and some of these others. There's more eyes on you probably at Texas than just about anywhere, but it's been done before, and it can happen at Texas if they get the right guys. So if you're asking me for one name, I guess the safest pick out of that group would probably be Sarkisian because of his head coaching experience, because he's been under Saban for a little while now and probably learned some of the ropes there. He'd probably be the safest name, but I'm kind of tired of seeing Texas go for the safest name. So, but I think Dustin summed it up really well. I would talk to and get a feel for every hot coordinator I think that has a bright future, and that would be where my pool might start with those guys.
Anwar, I don't want to speak for you. I just have a feeling after reading your stuff for months now that you weren't buying any of that.
No. not of it. Not of it. To be fair, I mean, Tom Herman was a little bit outside of the box, if you think
not
about
really.
It.
Well, he was the hot name.
No, no. Tom Herman was the guy.
He was hot after one season. Like, it was the
LSU and Texas were fighting over him. He was the hot coaching name when Texas hired him.
But that he was hot after 1 year as a head coach. Like, think back to it, because everyone ignores the second season. Like, everyone ignores that he went 9-3 the following year, and they lost to Navy, SMU, and Memphis. And they got smashed by SMU in year two. So it was – but it was really after one – I'm not saying that, you know, but that was a little bit, I think, outside the box, you know, when it was all said and done. Like, you guys may disagree, but hiring a guy who really – Ketch, you would attest that after year one, Texas pretty much had its eyes set on Tom Herman.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, and Anwar, to your point, because I can't be a hypocrite here. I somewhat view Herman in the between what you guys are talking about, but I've spent the better part of the last couple of years saying that Texas needs to stop guessing with Charlie Strong and guessing with Tom Herman and find a way to buy a guarantee on the box, which is why I'm totally was totally on board, would still be totally on. If Texas privately is saying we're going to wait until January and we're going to make Urban Meyer tell us no again before we go off and hire Graham Harrell. Totally get it. Because
that plan too. Yeah.
Because I totally understand. Cause for me, if it can be obtained, you have to go get, you have to change. The definition of insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over and over again. And I agree that Graham Harrell's not the same, or Tony Elliott's not the same kind of candidate that Tom Herman was, but they all fall under the category where I think Anwar and I agree. They're not guarantees on the boxes. And if you really want to do something different, go find what Jimbo Fisher ultimately has been for Texas A&M. I mean, the question about Jimbo wasn't quality. It was, does he even still have his head in it? Does he want to do it? Because at the end of Florida State, he felt like a guy with 1 foot out and 1 foot in. And who knows, once you, you know, Mac was that way. And then he came back to North Carolina and seems to be recharged. But you got to know. And I just feel like all of the problem that Texas has is this is, there just aren't a lot of guarantees on the boxes. They went for the one that they could get. But now what they can't do is nothing because of the actions that have already been taken. But Anwar, I feel you in that when I hear all of this stuff, if the answer is who does a better job in 2021, a new coach with new coordinators or even a new coach with the same coordinators or bringing back the current coach with the current staff and let them have a spring and all that other stuff, a one-year snap, I feel like you keep Herman, that there's nobody that's a guarantee on the box. And in a world where that can't happen, maybe you wait until you can get one. That I just can't get beyond the fact that everybody in this circle of five makes complete sense. I get it. But everybody's approaching this from a slightly different angle because what's transpired and the idea of actually bringing Herman back, just radar, like alarm bells are going off because we all are like, man, recruiting's going to be dead. And, you know, what are you going to do? But it's right now that they're in this spot. It just, you know, they've done this to themselves and how they get out of it is really complicated. It's more complicated, a complicated situation on war, really complicated. Everything about what Texas has been involved in, really starting with the pandemic, right? Seven coaches come in, seven going out, technically three new coordinators, if you want to count special teams. And then the pandemic hits, really complicated. We're asking all these questions. What does it mean to not have spring and not have those 15 practices? And what does it mean to not have what does it mean to have your kids doing their off-season workouts in their home gym? Like, all complicated. Then the Eyes of Texas thing happens, and it's really complicated. It's not as easy as, well, this is the answer. Then everybody can just agree on it. That's not what exists. And then it gets more complicated, the band and the cheerleaders, and it's not just football players all of a sudden. And then you play the song at the wrong time. It stays complicated. And then you get into this, then it's the reaction to that gets to be complicated. And then going into the coaching search gets to be complicated. All this is complicated, but I can't get beyond how they made it more complicated, that there is a pandemic and the Eyes of Texas thing is complicated and finding a new coach is complicated. But every single action that they've taken, probably other than the pursuit of Urban Meyer, and even that left collateral damage, but like, I get it. We all get that. But almost everything else, I don't know, man. And it's hard to think about what they do next without my brain constantly going back to, well, it all could have been different if they just hadn't been a bunch of assholes.
Well, I mean, and then you go past that, though, Ketch. It's because, you have that, but then you also have the complicated thing of losing to TCU again, you know, losing to an Oklahoma team, you know, that essentially was throwing in the white towel because they benched their starting quarterback.
That happened.
Yes. And they lose that game, you know, the Iowa State game that occurs. And you think of something simplistic as, okay, if you just kick this little field goal, even if Iowa State scores, you know, late in that game, you just go into overtime and have a chance to win because you love to play in overtime. And, you know, so you also have those little things, too, that add into the mix of the pandemic, add into the Eyes of Texas. Like, there is also that frustration of the product on the field. Seeing Sam Ellinger for the most part be good but not great this season, and not being the quarterback that we thought was going to dominate every single matchup, and then looking at next year where you got to hope that Hudson Card just becomes some sort of like instant legend, like, right? I mean, that was what would need to occur for something. If Tom Herman is here next year, Hudson Card has to become this, you know, this dude. Sorry to Alex, who I know is a Casey Thompson fan. But if it's Casey or Hudson, either one of those has to be a team that, if you're playing a 12 game season, gets Texas to like a 10 win plateau where you could feel a little bit better about it. And but that's also asking a lot for a first year starter to be able to do. So I think that adds to like the dire situation. And then the frustration of like, okay, well, who can make this better next year? Because I think we all think Urban Meyer comes in. And this is the other part catch to consider. If Urban Meyer comes in, you know, we operate under the assumption that Urban Meyer will probably flip the switch in year one. If not, we really pretty much going to assume that it happens in year two. The other question is, if you have some of these other guys who are unproven, how much time do they really get? Like you get what, do you give them 2 years? And then after year two, there's a lot of frustration because you know what's going to happen. You know, it's going to be, I got to recruit my guys. These aren't Tony Elliott guys, right? these are Tom Herman guys. The same way that Tom Herman inherited Charlie Strong guys, and the same way Charlie Strong inherited Mack Brown guys, right? So it's going to be, these aren't my guys. He's got to get his guys. He's got to get his recruiting class in. And then do we kick it down the can down the curve to, well, you know, if they just win, then they're going to get recruits in. So now it's just about winning. You know, it's like everything I've seen since I've been here. It's just like one after one coach after another. So, and then after like year two or three, if it's not happening, then it's like, ah, damn, we just got to get rid of him and find someone else. Like,
Anwar, I think that's a great point. I want to catch you in the middle of it,
sure,
right?
Sure.
This idea of anybody they hire now that's any of these guys that we've thrown out there, to me, it didn't start working out probably after year one. You can start looking at it like a shotgun marriage. Well, this wasn't even the guy we were supposed to have, right? So if you have a shotgun marriage and 12 months in, you don't like it, you can talk yourself into, well, it was a shotgun marriage, bad idea, let's just get out of it. If you've been engaged for like a year and a half and you spend $100,000 on a wedding and you're unhappy 12 months in, you're like, I spent all that, but we spent a lot of money on the wedding. We spent so much money on the wedding, we have to give it years to do. And I think what you're right about is that hiring somebody potentially in this climate really sets that coach up to either do it really fast or through no fault of their own other than, I think there's a caricature of Texas at its fan base, the 9 Jerry Joneses. And I've defended Texas nationally on a few radio shows this week where I've said there are 9 Jerry Jones in every major college football program in the country. And if any of those major football programs lose for a decade straight, they're going to be around. But you run the risk. And I don't think Texas has been a caricature of itself yet. But I think if you hire, let's say Tony Elliott, right? I throw that name out there because I don't think he has a snowball's chance in hell. They hire Tony Elliott, and next year they go 7-5, which could be easily happen given the state of the roster and another turnover and new coordinators and all of that stuff. I think behind the scenes, like kind of like Red McCombs did with Charlie, we saw it a little bit with Charlie. Saban was supposed to be the guy. And the very moment the new guy looked vulnerable at all, it was like, he's in over his head. We need to get somebody new. And so Charlie didn't get 4 years. He got 3. And I think you're much more likely to hire whoever that guy is. You're probably going to put him on a 3-year timetable, which is completely unfair. Whereas at some point, the madness does have to stop. They can't every three. The expectations can't be new guy comes in, the program isn't where it needs to be, and magically it gets better. Because only the Urban Meyers of the world truly ever pulled that off.
Well, that to me is why you have to, above, I think, everything else, value the recruiting element. Because if Tom Herman's got the Brockermeyers committed and he's got Quinn Ewers committed for the next class, I don't think we're having this kind of conversation right now. So if you bring in a guy, and yeah, maybe he goes 7-5 or 8-4 or something like that in the first year, but he's recruiting at a really, really high level, the conversation changes.
Does it? So I mean, Charlie recruited at
a hell high. Yeah. No, he didn't.
He had darn near top 10 classes, you know.
No.
So did Tom early in his career, the first couple of years.
Well, I mean, Tom Herman technically had two top 5 classes.
But we're talking about now. And now he doesn't. And that's the problem.
Well, I'm just saying, but like, it's parallel, right? Because at some point, the winning has to happen, right? Tom had two top 5 classes, and we see the results of that. So I get what you're saying. I'm just, my only pushback on that is we've seen coaches come in here and recruit well. And I'm not saying you can't value recruiting, but you know, Charlie was recruiting when he wasn't winning. I mean, this guy was coming off a 6-win season.
Charlie was never recruiting at an Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, Ohio State, LSU level. He wasn't stacking the roster full of nationally elite guys. And the recruiting changes the entire conversation. Because that's what people are going to start pointing to. It's like okay, we had a bad year, but you know what? This guy's recruit. He's got a top 5 class. He's got a bunch of national top 250 guys. He's got top guys from the state of Texas. Because the problem with where Tom Herman is right now is that one bad recruiting class doesn't just hurt you the next year. Part of the main reason why is they haven't recruited, because you have one bad class and that affects you on the field, and then you have another bad class, and it just starts to be a perpetual issue over and over and over again. So that to me is why, if Texas ultimately does decide to make a change, you've got to value recruiting above all else. You have to. You have to get the guys in.
Can I just say what I always say, and Ketch will probably get.
I always feel like you make this a shot at me. By the way,
it is. But can I say how many 4 and 5 stars do you need to beat TCU consistently? How many 4 and 5 stars do you need to beat Iowa State consistently? How many 4 and 5 stars do you need to beat the Baylors of the world, or the Oklahoma States of the world, the Oklahoma States that went 7-10 against you last year? Like, I get this recruiting thing, but it's like, what frustrates me in the context of this conversation when we have it is, it's like recruiting against in the Alabama levels or the Clemson levels and all these other, you know, high levels. And I'm like, yeah, at some point, what levels do you need to beat TCU? Like, I get it, but at some point, can you get a coach in here who can handle Gary Patterson? Because Gary Patterson doesn't really kill it all year long, but he sure as hell's find a way to kill it against every Texas coach that he finds and plays against. I mean, how many do you need to beat Mike Gundy? How many need to beat Matt Campbell? Just the frustrating thing. I'm not, and it's not a you thing, Dustin. I'm not attacking.
Well,
you.
Well, here's the but issue is at some that's point, like, that's not the bar for Texas. The bar for Texas is to win the conference every year and get into potential playoff conversations.
That's the desired standard that happened 2 times under Mac Brown.
I think it happened more than that. I mean, the playoff wasn't around back then. He routinely had 10-win seasons, was in that kind of conversation. I mean,
he had 5 teams. 2001 almost played for a national championship. 2008 should have played for a national championship. 2009 should have, or did. 2005 did.
And 2004 went to the Rose Bowl.
They were good enough at the end to be in that conversation, but they weren't really, I don't know, they wouldn't have been a playoff team, but at the end, I think they finished top 5. So they had 5 teams in 10 years.
There's a clear gap right now in college football between the haves and the have-nots, and that's all because of recruiting. And right now, Texas is in the have-nots. They don't have a roster that could compare to Clemson, Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia, LSU. They can't. They have some of those guys, but just go look at the national top 100 recruits and where they're going. They're not going to Texas. They're going to Oklahoma. They're going to all these other programs, and the gap is just getting wider. And
not going to TCU.
Okay, that's fine. I mean, I'm not debating your point that a coach should be TCU.
Big 12
teams. That's why those teams aren't ever competing for a college football playoff appearance. That's why Mike Gundy 3 games again for the 9th year in a row. That's why Gary Patterson is in the middle of another bad season. That's why Iowa State hasn't won a conference championship in over 100 years. They don't recruit consistently, so they can't compete consistently. That's the difference. And that's the sort of thing that if the fan base sees a guy that's hired and, you know, okay, you know, 7-5, 8-4, whatever. but he's got a nationally elite recruiting class. That has hope for the future. Then you start to improve the roster. Then you get to the conversation where, okay, this is actually moving forward. Texas is moving down. And that's a big reason why the fan base and a lot of other people want change, because they can just look at the recruiting and say, where's the hope? There's no Brockermeyers. There's no Ewers. There's no Billy Bowman. There's no Kamar Wheaton. There's no Bryce Foster. These guys are going to Oklahoma or these other programs. And that's the big reason why the conversation is where it is right now.
Okay. Mac won a Big 12 championship in 05 and 09.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, I hear it's like the
and TCU is going to win like what, five games?
Okay, but again, I'm just saying
Oklahoma State Oklahoma State never competes for conference titles consistently. Iowa State never does it consistently. Baylor never does it consistently. Texas Tech is a train wreck. Like, why do you think these programs are where they are?
But you know what?
They don't have the talent.
I'm going to be the mediator here because I feel both of you. And here's what I would say to Anwar. Anwar's looking at step one, and he's like, you guys are talking about playoff. You guys aren't beating TCU, Oklahoma State consistently, and how many 2 stars, 3 stars, 5 stars do you need to do that? Those teams are middle of the pack. You can't beat them. I think that the part that Anwar slightly misses, and to his credit, shit, he's never seen it since he's been here. They've still been in the got to beat TCU first mode. So he hears plans about running when he hasn't seen walking yet. What I would say is the transition, it's a little bit like shifting gears. So you got to shift from first to second. And what happens is you want to get to like fifth gear, 2, 3, and 4 happen like real quick. That's what happens at this job. So what happens is the moment Herman, let's say Herman specifically, if he beats Oklahoma State, let's say they go 8-2 and they make it to the Big 12 championship game, but he beats TCU and he beats Oklahoma State. And let's say he does that like just in a year. I think in a year, the expectations at that point, TCU's in the rearview mirror, all the teams that they're losing to are in the rearview mirror. And then it becomes, you better beat Oklahoma, Jack, because that suddenly is the only game that matters. And then it's as soon as you beat Oklahoma, you got to be ready to beat the next teams. So recruiting is about the long away dream of one day needing to be in a position to hang with the Ohio States in the world in a playoff game, which Oklahoma hasn't proven yet that they can even do. Why? Because Oklahoma doesn't have the Jimmies and the Joes that Ohio State does. However, I can't help but think about the Slack conversation that we were having this week as a staff and the juxtaposition behind what Oklahoma is doing right now in recruiting and pulling in 5 stars and the best quarterback in the country. And give me the rundown again, Jason. Number one quarterback.
Sorry, they've got the number one ranked. We're talking 2022. They got the number one ranked quarterback, or 2021. I'm sorry, number one ranked quarterback in the country committed. They've got the number two wide receiver in the country committed. Most people seem to think they're going to get the number one wide receiver in the country committed next week. So you've got the number. Or, I'm sorry, tomorrow.
And that's the sound of the gap getting wider.
Yeah. Texas, so you've got the number one quarterback. Probably the number one and number two ranked receivers. They are, I think most people would say, the leader for Kamar Wheaton, the number one ranked running back. I mean, obviously they're in the Bryce Foster sweepstakes. I mean, I can't agree with Dustin Moore on this. I mean, Texas and Oklahoma are, Oklahoma is turning into an Alabama, an Ohio State type of program.
The difference between Lincoln Riley and Bob Stoops.
Oklahoma is threatening to turn into the Clemson of the Big 12.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
And real quick, I think this is important from a framing standpoint, because I think two of the worst classes that Texas has had in recruiting in the last 20 years were 2017 and 2020. I mean, excuse me, 2017 and 2021, what this class will appear, what it appears to be headed for. So what you've got is a situation where very recently, two of your last five recruiting classes are among the worst you've ever had. So as much as Charlie and as much as Tom and as much as, not so much Mac, but those two guys got here and they were like, whoa, it's not good enough. It was better than it is now. It really was. Like, the recruiting from a pure raw talent standpoint, it wasn't getting developed, but it looked better on paper. I think the big concern now is, if you throw 2022 away, then three of the worst classes that you've had in the last quarter century are all within a very close proximity of each other. And that is occurring at the same time that Oklahoma is finally doing what Bob Stoops wasn't able to do in recruiting. That is why Oklahoma is so thrilled with Lincoln Riley. It's not the volume of the winning. It's the increased appetite for recruiting. It's the one thing you wouldn't get if Bob Stoops took over the Texas job, Alex, in theory, is that Bob doesn't have any more desire to recruit now than he did when he was 20 years younger. He never liked recruiting. Lincoln Riley does. They recruit at a much higher level, and the talent gap for them between Ohio State and Clemson's of the world is changing. The next time they get into a playoff, it very well might be that they finally have a roster that can do that. Texas fans, when they talk about recruiting, look through the prism of only being able to compete against Ohio State, Clemson, and Alabama. It's why I constantly get asked, what year do I think Texas is going to be in the playoff? It never goes away. And Texas doesn't want to be in a playoff game right now. If Texas wins the Big 12 next year, and if they win the Big 12 and they made it to a playoff, I don't even need to know the opponent. The opponent would rip their guts out. They don't want to play Clemson with time to prepare. No, that is like Texas isn't even remotely ready for that. And they won't be. Like, they're not in that conversation. And that conversation doesn't change until recruiting is elite for a stretch. And Texas hasn't had an elite of an elite recruiting year in a long time. As I've outlined, a top 10 class is not the same as a top 5 class. You start getting into top 10, it doesn't matter. Because as the metrics prove, national top 75 kids and better, those are the kids that are difference makers. I hear national top 250 and I yawn. Those guys pan out at less than 20% rates. The kids that Oklahoma is getting in this class, those kids pan out at like 50% rates. And when you sign eight of them, then four of those guys, like you look at them and you go, well, you got like four future All-Americans. I can't tell you who they are because I can't do that. But the math says a couple of these guys will fail, but at least a half of them will be big-time Mac Daddies. And when you look at Texas, they're in the same position. I mean, you know, Bijan Robinson, that's what – what we saw Saturday, imagine having 10 of those guys in your roster. 10 5-stars, two every year. I mean, that is how you start putting guys on the field that win championships. Texas only has one Bijan Robinson on offense. Brennan Eagles was close to that level of a prospect. He's probably their best receiver. They can't get him the ball enough. But, like, they just don't have enough of those guys. When we look at the defensive side of the ball, I mean, you know, Caden Stearns is a 5-star, and like that's at the back end of what 5-stars should produce. He's been like a 3-year starter. He's going to likely be drafted in the NFL. We think. He thinks. But like,
he thinks.
He thinks, but like that's like on the – usually, like that's as bad as it gets. He's just been pretty – he's been a serviceable Big 12 starter and nothing better than that. And that's usually like the bottom of the barrel. But like usually the best players in this roster are the guys that were the highest recruited.
Listen, Texas
receiver,
class,
highest recruited.
Texas's class right now, Ketch, ranks 17th in the Rivals rankings. And to your point, that's probably closer to the 40th ranked recruiting class than it is a top five recruiting class.
Oh, it is. It is.
The gap, once you get past that top five, six, seven, you know, from 15 to 50, you might as well just throw them all in a bag.
And then it comes down to who's coaching, because the talent's roughly all the same. And then that's how Gary Patterson keeps beating Texas. Because suddenly he's a better developer of talent, and he's not being overwhelmed in that process the way he once was. Anyway, it's a very nerdy recruiting conversation. And
Texas is in that second tier. Oklahoma is trending towards the top of that top.
I think Anwar just tuned us out. I really
just, because the only reason I'm listening, but you know, we could go down to speak. This is another podcast to have a conversation on, because I get that OU 21-21 class is chilling a 2022 class. I mean, does Texas only have maybe one guy committed 2022? So it's no ranking, but overall, prior to that, didn't Texas typically have higher-ranked classes than OU?
I mean, they did, which is scary, and they still can't.
So I mean, that, so that's what throws me off a little bit when they, when I hear, when we talk about the rankings and you talk about where OU is. I'm like, well, technically, from like 2010, Texas typically. There's, I've looked through while guys were talking. There's been a couple of years when since in you know there, OU had a better class, ranked class in 2013 and 14, and then 2017. And outside of that, Texas has had higher ranked classes. So it is this just. It's just a conversation that probably just one of the things I just won't understand.
Matt Brown wasn't as good of a coach as Bob Stoops, ever.
I mean, Bob Stoops. By the way, Oklahoma has the number one ranked receiver commitment in 2022 as well. So I mean, it just.
But now they're now they're on next level.
I mean, it was weird because Stoops just didn't have a taste for recruiting, and consequently, for the majority of his career, Oklahoma couldn't figure out where they needed to be recruiting. I mean. They used to get frustrated that Texas, no matter how bad Oklahoma, like donkey punched them on the field. And there was a point where they had beaten them every year from 2000 to 2004. And only a couple of those games were remotely close. And the close ones were weirdly as haunting as the blowouts. And like, it was constant. And really, it took 5 years, way back in the beginning of all of this, when Stoops and Mack were in their early, early run. It wasn't until 2004 when Rhett Bomar and Adrian Peterson went to Oklahoma that Texas ever felt it in recruiting, that Oklahoma just couldn't touch Mack. And then after he won in 04 and 05, not beating Oklahoma, but just winning in general, it picked back up, and Oklahoma could never touch Texas recruiting inside the state of Texas ever again. So then Oklahoma was bouncing in and around Florida, and where they were going to California and Nevada, and they were having some success there, but they weren't consistently great. In part because Bob just wasn't great at that. Now they have figured out the right combination of building around kids from the state of Texas, but not living in the state of Texas to the point where they're taking TCU level recruits because they don't have any other natural. They've expanded their natural recruiting territories over the course of the last decade and a half so that you go into a place like Las Vegas and you say, Who do you have to worry about in recruiting? And they'll say Oklahoma. It doesn't make any damn sense, except they've stacked enough success there now that they can walk into high school in Las Vegas and kids are like, oh, that's where we go. Same thing in areas of Florida now. They are now having enough success in various places. And weirdly, Jimbo Fisher has built A&M up in the most ass-backwards way I've ever seen. He hasn't been able to recruit the state of Texas at all. But that dude's been able to take his assistant coaches in the most remote places I can imagine. I've never seen
New
a school.
Jersey.
I've never seen a school from Texas recruit the way Fisher has. I didn't think it would work. I was like, oh, this is those kids are going to get home.
It may not long term. I'm still not.
And it may not. But they got a good team this year, and like their recruiting is still really good. They just still haven't started. I'm fascinated to see if where Texas. Needs to be concerned is that they're getting their ass kicked in 2021 right now, but there's not a dominant team. I mean, it's not like A&M is cleaning up in Texas like Jackie Sherrill back in the day. It's not even like Oklahoma's doing that. Everybody's having success. Everybody but Texas, all of a sudden. Texas having four of the state's top 35 prospects and the rivals Texas top 35 is again, it's historically bad. I think the number was exactly the same in 2017, otherwise known as the shit stain class. If we, you know, I mean the player that name given by the players in it this year, shit stain 2.0. Next year could be shit stain 3.0. And I think that you are not going to win in championships. Clearly Texas hasn't. If you were stacking up shit stain classes, and shit stain classes at the University of Texas are anything where at the end you say, hey, top 35 kids in the state of Texas, how many did Texas get? 15? 10? 4. Oh, shit stain. That's where we are. But I understand where you're coming from. Cause you are like, we're talking about going to the moon. And you're talking about getting up off the ground. And I'm just saying that the reality is where the disconnect needs to connect is that the transition from, oh, you're off the ground, now you got to go to the moon immediately. That's where Texas fans are. I mean, if Tom were beating all the teams that he hasn't yet beaten consistently, but he was still 1-4 against Oklahoma, the fan base would be looking at, you can't beat Oklahoma and you can't beat the Ohio States of the world if, by God, you ever got into that game. They just haven't been good enough to even get close to being in those types of games other than that one Sugar Bowl. Anyway, let's go into parting shots. We could do this all day. Let's do parting shots and get on out of here so that we can all get lunch and move on with our days. Alex, I feel like I have not heard from you in at least 15 hot minutes and maybe more. You go first today. We made the guys go in reverse alphabetical order last week. So we'll go normal alphabetical order, which means Anwar, you're on deck. Alex, lead us off.
Well, just got done doing my film work for the week. Always enjoyed coming on these pods on Thursday because I know I don't have any of that hanging over me anymore. But I think my biggest takeaway from this last game, and I know everything surrounding the program and stuff, it feels like there's ominous clouds and a lot of uncertainty right now. And what, you know, part of the uncertainty was the fact that, you know, first of all, Derek Kerstetter, it felt just so sudden that, like, I've seen my last game with Sam Cosmi and now with Derek Kerstetter, you know, it happened like 3 weeks before I thought it was going to happen. But now that's the case. And now we've gotten actually finally to see what some of the depth pieces look like, or, you know, how they've come along and how the staff would plan to deploy them if they were needed right now, which two of them happened to be. Actually, there were three of them that got worked in that were sort of new faces on the offensive line on Saturday. And look, I wrote it in my column today, there's no way to come away from that game anything less than very encouraged with how Jake Majors looks and with how Andre Carrick look. Both of those guys move better than I thought. Majors is stronger than I thought. Carrick is much stronger than I thought. It doesn't move quite as well as I thought he might, but he's stronger than I thought. He's nasty with a great motor. And Majors, I mean, he has some strength issues in solo base assignments and this outside zone stuff that they're running, as far as, you know, I always talk about that upfield penetration through the outside shoulder and outside zone that was, you know, I always talk about it because it was troublesome even for Derek Kerstetter as a senior. And it's a little bit troublesome for Majors, but he hung in there. He played really well. That's your center for next year. 65 is your center for next year. I think the 69 is probably your left tackle for next year. And those things, knowing those things, makes you feel a little bit more comfortable. And the question now is, how bad was Kansas State? You know, I know people are going to say, and we're not going to get a good test versus Kansas. I get it. I understand all those things. And you could choose to look at it like that, or you could choose to look at it and like, dude, these guys didn't come in and fail versus Kansas State. They came in and actually played really well. I don't know about how you guys thought. I thought the run game looked like the best it had looked all year. I thought the holes that were opening up looked very, very good. The zone lanes that they were getting going in outside zone and inside zone all looked really good to me. The group looked tight and organized and in phase with one another, and almost the way they had, like, nobody's talked about the fact that the offensive line didn't commit a penalty in this game. None of them did. So it's it looked clean. It looked good. There's no way that anybody who follows this stuff closely could have come away anything but encouraged by the fact that now that we've seen the way a couple of these players look, as far as the key depth behind Kerstetter, behind Cosmi, what life's going to look like after those guys, and to a lesser degree, Denzel Okafor, in a season where, you know, things, you know, a season full of discouragement, at least for the immediate near term. We know how bad 2021 offensive line recruiting is. Like, we don't even need, it's a whole nother podcast. But at least for the immediate near term, I think people can feel encouraged that the players that Texas has in place to step up into some of those key roles along the offensive line actually looked up to muster.
Alex, if I gave you an assignment a week ago and said, rank the 2021 Longhorns, like the actual roster, not recruiting, like in the players in terms of most importance, I have a feeling the list would have looked one way. And then I feel like a week later, 7 days later, if I'd asked you that question last week, now I feel like Jake Majors and Carrick would both be significantly high on that list.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, They almost have zero experience, but what little we have, when we start ranking most valuable players in the program next year, I don't feel like the roll call will be very long before we hit their names.
No, I don't think so either, especially because it's, you know, it's going to be the offensive line is going to be replacing three starters. I mean, it's important that those guys are up to snuff, man. And I know people will say that, you know, it was Kansas State, but here's the thing, dude, Texas has had offensive linemen look shitty against Kansas State. I mean, it's just that's the way it is, man. It was a very supportive, like, I mean, you guys saw it. I mean, the group looked clean and good. Like, the group was in phase in a way that it was the damnedest thing. I came away really encouraged. I don't see how anybody else couldn't have, given the circumstances.
Mr. Richardson, batter up.
Okay, Ken, so you appreciate this story. So on, all you guys probably will. On Thanksgiving Day, I got an invite out to someone's house and spent the day there. But then they have a 15, 16-year-old who plays varsity basketball. And said person challenged me, just mind my own business, to a basketball game across the street at the park. So it was unfair. I felt like I had been drinking. It was late afternoon, so I already had some drinks in me. I was playing in my jeans. I had like regular shoes on. Yeah, I was dressed up, dressed up for, a nice day as opposed to playing basketball. And, at that moment, I realized that my mouth was working correctly, but my body just wasn't, right? I was just winded. I freaking had to take off my shirt at some point because I was hot. So I had just the dad bod with jeans and church shoes on. It's pathetic. And the kid beat me, right? And I said, like, look, just give me like about 2-3 weeks, just to regroup, repair. Like, yeah, I've got alcohol in me. I'll come back and I'll beat you. So I forgot about it, to be honest with you. And then on Sunday, I see the kid again, and the kid's like, hey, Anwar, we got that game coming up this week. I go, what? And they're like, yeah, you said this is the week that we play each other. I have it on my calendar. And I said, oh, really? And I said, all right. So I'll come over on Wednesday. So went to the house on Wednesday. The kid's like, yeah, I just woke up. This is yesterday, so it's going to be – I just can't believe I'm just going to come out here straight out of bed and beat you like this. And I'm like, wow, okay, you're really talking a lot of smack here. And so, but I'm in like old man gear, right? I got my sweats on. I got my knee brace on. Like, I'm in my old man gear. And they're like, you need to stretch? I'm like, oh, absolutely. I have to stretch. So I'm stretching like an old man would stretch. And then the kid goes, why don't we play for money? And I was like, I don't want to play for money. Let's just play. And it's like, no, let's play for money. I was like, how about this? I'll put $20 versus your no money. So you don't even have to worry about betting. They're like, listen, there's no way I'm even going to lose. So you can bet whatever you want to bet. I have got this. I was like, all right, so let's do 20 apiece. All right. And so catch, so here's the game. I say, here's the game. We're going to play to 11 by ones, three pointers or twos, make it, take it, ball up top. And I went against a teenager. And catch, I beat her ass. Oh, I beat her ass. I beat her ass yesterday, baby. Oh, you can blink. It was 10-1. The final score was 11-3. She was talking about how I cheated because I would call the foul. And oh yeah, and just so for clarity, she's 5'7", a good like buck 70. So she's got some weight in her ass. Now don't act like I didn't have to go against a really formidable young lady, but I beat her ass yesterday, 11-3. That's right. The old man's back, baby. I think that old man, like, smart you out, they outthink you kind of stuff. Like, all the little tricks of the trade, like the old people used to do at the park when we were younger, and we just didn't understand how they kept scoring. That's what I did.
Well, I'm back, baby. I want you to know something.
Yes.
I have never been more proud of you.
I was about to give Omar like such props. Way to go. Yes, for the old guys.
I beat her ass. Yeah, I left out the gender on purpose, but yeah, she's five. Look, she's 5'7", about 170, plays in high school. So she, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, there's a 30-year difference here, and she beat me.
Did you throw her shit into the stands at some point? Because you got a lot of length. I have to believe at some point you rejected her in a disturbing way.
No, I had to protect my knees, man.
He drew some beautiful charges, I bet, though.
there was a couple of blocks, but not like back in the day, though. There was Sook a couple.
Kamel has never felt more connected to you.
So
he can close his eyes and imagine it. God, I don't know how to follow that up, but Dustin, you have that task.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to go from one high-level basketball game to another high-level basketball game last night at the Irwin Center, which, you know, Greg Brown did block a shot, and he spiked it, and it hit a Texas State player in the head. So, you know, I'm a little disappointed Anwar didn't have that moment during his pickup game. But Texas did play Texas State last night. A Texas State team that I think the average fan probably doesn't realize it's actually kind of decent. I mean, it's a team that won 21 games last year. And was a top 100 KenPom team last year, about in the 150 range right now. But it was a pesky Texas State team. Texas didn't quite pull away. It kind of had a weird, I don't know if it was the pandemic or the arena or the opponent or what it was. It was almost like a little bit of an exhibition style kind of vibe to the game. It was almost kind of like the way Texas was taking that at sometimes, just a really, you know, trying to go up and down and you know, not so much worry about what was happening, but just kind of chasing the next dunk opportunity or something like that. But Texas ended up in the second half really responding well and won that game by 21 points. But it's about to get real again for the Longhorns, because they open up Big 12 play this Sunday in Waco against number 2 Baylor. And if they're going to have any chance to win that game, and I've seen Baylor a couple times, they're absolutely the real deal. They're going to have to bring a much more consistent, tough rebounding presence on the glass. It's something that Baylor has routinely been good at under Scott Drew, is they always have tough guys in the paint. They're going to fight you for rebounds and really turn that into a physical battle for anything that comes off the glass. And that's the way the Indiana game was shaping up heading into tip off, and Texas responded extremely well. And against North Carolina, it didn't. So the rebounding remains a little bit of a question mark heading into that Baylor game. But I think you look at Texas right now so far with its non-conference schedule heading into this early start of Big 12 play because of the pandemic. And you got to say it's been successful for the Longhorns. They win the Maui Invitational. They do drop a home game against Villanova, but a game that could have easily went either way, a game that, you know, Texas showed it's fully capable of playing against true national championship contenders. And it's going to see another one of those teams on Sunday. And, we'll see what happens with Greg Brown too, because that was kind of a little bit of a, you know, not a full coming out party, but he scored 18 points and I think only about 22 minutes last night against Texas State, caught fire from beyond the arc in the second half. You know, he looked like a guy that's the game starting to slow down for him a little bit. And he was really candid after the game. It was our first time to talk to him, I think, since he signed with Texas, and just discussed you know, the struggles on the offensive end. And he said the tightness of the help side defense has been the biggest surprise to him. And he said, you know, I'm learning that, you know, I'm not a one-man show like I was in high school. I've got to make the right plays for the team and that sort of thing. And I think he did a better job of that last night. And I think too, a noteworthy thing was just the way that Matt Coleman and Courtney Ramey led on the floor in that second half. Very, very vocal, very demonstrative. I mean, there is a moment where Texas was kind of struggling the first half. You know, Coleman didn't even let the team get to the coaching staff in the huddle. He huddled everybody up, had a lot of things to say, and he's always been a leader. But you're kind of seeing those guys a little bit of a different voice this year, because I think this team understands that their expectations are very real and they're capable of reaching them. So looking forward to see how this game plays out this Sunday, but it's going to be a really, really tough test for the Longhorns. But they've already had a few of those this year with, you know, the Maui Invitational and then the home game against Villanova.
I got to say, Dustin, I thought last night was the first time I've seen Greg Brown and thought to myself, there it is. Looks like a young Jeff Ketchum.
Or an old Anwar Richardson.
For the first time. I've been waiting for that switch to be like, there he is. I know that guy. That used to be. No, it's first time. Good job, Greg Brown. You've taken the step. Mr. Sukumel, are you going to talk about anything other than Jatavion Sanders? Like, that was good news last night.
Yeah, it was good news for Texas for me to get that response from him and someone at his coach saying he is going to sign with Texas on Wednesday. And it was surprising. I mean, I've texted Jatavion probably, I don't know, over the course of his recruitment, 15, 20 times. He never, ever responds. This is a guy who never talks to anybody. He didn't even talk to his own coaches. And I sent him a direct message on Twitter and a text last night, and he probably didn't realize he was responding to the same person, but he responded to both of them. I couldn't believe it. So Jatavion actually confirmed he is going to sign with Texas on Wednesday. That's kind of my parting shot. We haven't talked about it, but a week from today, as we record – or no, today's Thursday. I'm sorry, a week from yesterday is the first day of the early signing period. I'm expecting every one of Texas's commitments except for Michael Mislinski to sign their letters of intent. Now, we'll see. Hey, it's 6 days later, man. Things can change. But barring anybody getting cold feet, I've confirmed with every one of the Texas commits or people close to them, they are planning on signing next week on Wednesday. So all things considered, with everything going on with the coaching situation and so many unknowns and uncertainties, that's about as best you could hope for Texas. Obviously, you'd love to still have some of those guys like a Billy Bowman and some of these guys who peeled off. You'd love to be in a better situation with some of those guys. But look for Texas to sign. As of now, I'm expecting 18 guys, 18 of the 19 to sign. Texas will have to probably work to hold on to Michael Mislinski, the offensive lineman out of Florida. But, yeah, good news from Jatavion Sanders directly last night and should be good news overall. I mean, we've been talking about it. It's not going to be the star-studded class Texas expects or probably should have had. But, you know, I tell you what, if you'd have told me 3 weeks ago that 18 of their 19 are going to sign, I would have thought you were crazy. I would have thought more kids would have waited to see what's going to happen with the coaching situation and signed in February. But it's looking like the overwhelming majority will sign next weekend with Texas.
I wonder if that's because, like, the one-time transfer rule, technically they could get the hell out if they wanted to, right?
I guess they could once they got on campus, right?
I mean, I don't know.
You have to report and then leave.
Typically, whenever these coaching, if something happened on the coaching front, usually
let them out. Yeah.
But
I would think this year they would.
But I also wonder if, like, the transfer thing, some kid wanted to transfer in August. Mm-hmm. Even though I bet there'd be no punishment because nobody else is getting. I don't know.
I don't get the impression that's why these guys are doing it, but it may be something in the back of their mind.
I just don't know that there's the risk that there would have been. You know what I mean? They're like, it's less risky in that it seems like if they were unhappy, there wouldn't be a punishment to secure things up. Anyway, but you are moving up the mod rankings. So
hey, I need all the help I can get.
Yeah. So
because you know what? When it comes to 2022 recruiting, I'm going to be sliding right back down.
I've reached the zenith and it may not get better for a while. My final one is actually related to Jatavion Sanders. I just wanted to say, I don't always get on the beat up on rivals.com fence. But every time I've seen a highlight of Jatavion Sanders this year, I've been like, there. Like last weekend, you guys saw it, right? Snags the ball with one hand out of the air, and he is freaky. He plays tight end. He plays defensive end. Every time I see that kid, and I've seen a highlight of him from this year, I've thought, man, that's what a five-star looks like right there. And then to go to the Rivals rankings last week and see him at 13, if there are 12 better kids in the state of Texas than Jatavion Sanders, this is the greatest class in the state of Texas ever, ever. And I don't believe that to be the case. I think Rivals has that way wrong. And I don't know how much of an influence I have in 2020, but I will send an email just that says, fellas, open your eyes. I don't know what you could possibly be looking at, because I've seen the guys they have ranked ahead of Jatavion Sanders. And them dudes don't all deserve to be ranked ahead of Jatavion Sanders. And that is my final parting shot. Just a little bit of angry recruiting ranking stuff, because in my mind, Jatavion Sanders absolutely belongs in the 50-50 chance to be an NFL player. He does not belong in this category of mere mortals. And on that note, for myself, Anwar, Alex, Dustin, and Jason, thank you for hanging in with us in what turned out to be like almost a 90-minute podcast. Assuming you stayed with us this long and you heard Anwar's funny story and everything else that followed, thank you. We'll do it again next week. Later.